Hi, this is GW. We are continuing the conversation that we had yesterday, it was yesterday, on the subject of Brexit and Turkey, by and large. But Kumiko, Daniel and myself, being the people we are, it can sometimes wander a little, for which I offer no apologies. We'll try and remain a little bit more disciplined today, and we're going to begin where we left off with a discussion, hopefully a definition, of that phenomenon which is rising across Europe and which is very much feared by the EU elites, and which is populism. Daniel, you asked Kumiko to define this phenomenon. I think that's quite a tough ask, but
yes, I asked her.
Okay.
To define that for us.
Okay. Populism is a situation where civil servants and top politicians find that they no longer have exclusive decision-making power because there are other factions of the political class which have decided to align themselves with the will of the people, which is contrary to what they want to do. And so they find themselves in a pitched battle for things which they thought were simply taken as given.
There's a imposed moral, probably pseudo-moral, meaning to populism. You know, it's always trying to communicate this sort of sneer when the elites talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's an interesting area to explore. For me, when most people become aggressive, it's probably because they're quite frightened. And I think that there is something about the rise of the right, you know, which is behind all of this type of sneering activity. They're trying desperately not to have us break through and start speaking our truths to people. Because that, you know, has to be the end from their point of view. They've no longer got control, and everything's going to run away, and they're going to find themselves broken and defeated and on the scrap heap of history. So they tend to sort of use this term always in the same way, which is always negative, but not as strongly so, obviously, as saying somebody's a racist or a bigot or a fascist. But populist means very much the same thing. It means that the people don't actually have any right of their own to their opinions and any expression of those opinions in order to get people's support must be somehow illegitimate or unacceptable. So that's how I would approach a definition of it. I would leave that sort of strange moral stricture hanging in there somewhere. It's a very curious thing that for a political force in general, you know, the liberal establishment, let's say, which is so completely convinced of its rightness that it so readily takes recourse to these kinds of stratagems where they can impute upon something a lesser moral or intellectual standing. They wouldn't need to do that if they thought they could really deal with us. So they must know they are at risk. So you're going to say? You're not going to say?
No, I'm in full agreement with that. I mean, they have this kind of sneering attitude they've been bringing constantly, where it's almost like, you know, these people, how are they speaking? And so on and so forth. If they had actually managed the situation effectively from the start, then maybe they wouldn't even have this problem. But they don't blame themselves. They're always looking to blame. I mean, even the charge populism itself, the tone of voice that they say it in, it's like they're blaming something on the hearts of the people who are having this conversation with them. That there's something, as you said, morally deficient in them or something, as opposed to there being facts on one side and facts on the other and people having different interests. No, you know, the broad mass of the people seem to be told that they have no interest actually, or that they don't even know what they are talking about.
But it's very anti-democratic, isn't it?
Time and time again. It also contradicts their claim that they're all about democracy and so on, because they've been beating people over the head with this democracy business for the longest time. Then when it actually happens, they're very shocked and upset about it.
I don't have any problem at all with saying we are populists. You know, I suppose if one has to get into the political game, it's much better to be popular than it is to be unpopular. And these people, liberals, seem not to understand that. And, you know, I don't know whether they embrace their unpopularity when they talk like this, but probably not.
Yeah, and they believe fervently that it's almost like Like, you know, you have these people who believe they're both strong and weak at the same time. In this case, we end up with, you know, liberals who believe they're both popular and unpopular at the same time. So, you know, they're very beleaguered, and they, you know, they act as though they're very beleaguered. But then when you present your opinion to them, they'll say, oh, who believes that? Only a narrow group of racists believes that.
Maybe that can...
I've had someone say that to me about the referendum itself. You know, oh, only a narrow strip of racists believes such and such. And I'm like, well, actually, 52% of the people actually voted to leave.
And it's more than that, because if you take out those who wanted to vote but were bludgeoned, you know, into the Remain camp by... this very crude policy of Project Fear, and there must have been a great number of them in actual fact. I don't think it was a completely unsuccessful strategy. I think it's probably as successful as it could have been from that of view. You know, well, those people...
Even the phrasing of the way that the poll was worded, the idea that you'd have, you know, remain within the European Union versus leave the European Union, that wording is quite deliberate. Yeah. Because they know that people are more inclined to choose the one that sounds like it's less of an effort that has to be made. Yeah, so, you know, remain sounds very cushy, like, you know, you don't have to do anything.
You, just have to... you know, more, you know, friendly and kind, let us remain. Exactly. You know, we don't want to do anything that's too ideological or too, you know, problematic for others. We should all be peaceful and friendly. You know,
maybe it connects with a Kantian source of liberalism, too, that they're... they're principled, and you have that negative connotation to popular philosophy by Immanuel Kant, and what the principled person does by contrast.
Maybe I don't know this because I've not actually read Kant. So it's a terrible admission to make, but I have never read.
Well, Kant. It's summed up in the article that I wrote, Kant's Moral Philosophy.
Right.
As coherence, accountability, agency, and warrant. It's only one page. It's not a big chore for anybody who wants. And the moral stuff is about the best of Kant.
I'll go back to it.
Consider also that the alternate wordings they could have used. They could have used, for example, they could have used stay versus exit. Why would they not have done that? We all know why they wouldn't do that. It's because that one makes exit sound too cuddly. So of course they're not going to use stay versus exit. It had to be remain versus leave. Well, if they had it their way, and like if they really, really had it their way, they'd probably have it be something like remain would have been listed as you know, stay in solidarity, or you know, cuddle in solidarity have a strop and quit like the evil racist you are. And that would be the second option.
Well, you know, we should be grateful for small mercies, because the Electoral Commission, which dictated the wording, was initially presented by the government with I don't remember the exact phrasing on this, but with a very one-sided formula, and they received protests from the leavers, as they became known, the outers, as I expect they were known at the time, and they came out after a few days with the judgment that they couldn't accept that government's proposal, and that they would come forward with their own, and this was it. So, you know, there were a number of little tricks that were employed in the run-up to the referendum by the forces of Remain, which, you know, for example, they tried to target young people, get them onto the electoral register. I think that they made it difficult for soldiers to register to vote.
Because they knew that soldiers were going to vote Leave.
Because soldiers, being a patriotic demographic, would vote Leave. They did everything they could, and in the end, it was defeated. I just wonder how much advantage they gained from all of that. It's probably a few percent at least. So the defeat, although it looked fairly narrow,
it would have been a lot more.
Might have been another 4 or 5 points. You never know. It could have been at 60-40, because I always thought 60-40 was the sort of area where it ought to have been. And in England, you know, probably most of England outside of the urban areas, it was 60-40. Anyway, it is now part of English history, a glorious moment that we've witnessed.
As is Boris Johnson, too.
Been updated as well.
Well, should we talk about the tragedy of Boris Johnson?
Go ahead.
Because there is a certain sort of know, Shakespearean tragic aspect to this. This is this great figure, and I mean great in the Falstaffian sense, who bestrides the stage, political stage, and manages somehow to make his way through political life merely by, you know, his energy, his vigor and charisma. And, you know, he is a remarkable character in many ways. But with such talents, if such they are, comes a number of fallibilities, it would seem. And the question which is hanging over the withdrawal of Boris from the process, the electoral process for a new prime minister, leader of the Conservative Party, is tending to, or suggesting, that there may have been sexual misdemeanors which he is not keen to have out in the public arena. And so, you know, the poor man has been forced to go through all of this, for him, quite difficult process ideologically, because he was never really a leaver. It was always a rather strained sort of thing for him. And he has now found himself having to explain that somehow or other he's not the man for the job, which is clearly not what he thought throughout the entire process. He thought he was precisely the man for the job, and he thought that the whole thing was going to take him into the job. So, I think it's quite a tragic story in political terms, and we'll probably never get the whole story of what's behind it. But there is one fellow on, I suppose you would say, the conservative blogosphere, who has put up a piece at The Spectator, and I'll just read this. Perhaps, after all, sexual morality does still matter in politics. This is an article in the Coffee House, The Spectator, written by Theo Hobson, and it begins, "This is not something we are keen to discuss, for we are pretty sure that we have become far less puritanical and that this is a good thing. But try this experiment. Imagine a slightly different version of Boris. Funny, human, brilliant, a bit chaotic seeming, and so on, but without any hint of sexual scandal." So on it goes. The writer doesn't actually make anything explicit at all.
But it must have been pretty bizarre, because the bar has gone up considerably nowadays with this sort of thing. I mean, you see the most ordinary people online carrying on before the world. Mm. So, they don't seem to care at all, and nobody seems to care that much. So it must have been pretty weird.
There is the possibility of weird, and you know, there is so much sex out there. You know, you have to say weird is probably the order of the day for most jaded palates, and maybe Boris has a jaded palate. Who can say? Well, somebody can say, I suspect, if that is the case, but not us.
Yeah, since 2012, people were saying, since 2012 there was the idea that Boris could not get into power because of the fact that some people knew something about him and had in their bottom drawer, essentially, a list of things to, I guess you could say, effectively blackmail him with. Mm. And so maybe this has come out to bite him now.
Mm.
But they've invoked it on him because they don't want him in that position. They're willing to invoke it on him.
Yeah. It still
The thing about these blackmail schemes, though, is that whenever there's a blackmail scheme, you have to ask yourself, how do they know these things? In other words, they would have to damage some of themselves in order to damage him with these things.
Probably because
they'd have to throw some of their own under the bus.
Breaks down and confesses to somebody or other, or confesses to a friend, more likely. And you know, these things slip out and somebody somewhere comes into possession of this information. I don't know. I mean, politics is a very incestuous thing and tends to also pull together people who are quite clubby, allied to a great deal of spiteful competition. Anyway, there we are. I think we can assume that, for the moment at least, Boris is out of it. Politically speaking, but don't write him off, because he is a force of nature, and sooner or later he'll be.
Well, isn't it good for you, because wasn't he competition for Michael Gove, who you prefer to have in there?
My feeling was that Gove was really trying to tell people that he wouldn't be the headline act. he wasn't going to be the person who was, you know, out there front of stage doing the stand-up comedy. That wasn't his routine. However, he did have hold of quite a lot of the line writing for the comedian out front. I think I said it in earlier conversation to you and Kamiko, not recorded, that we would be heading into the Govian age, because he has the intellect and the vision. There are very few who do in Westminster, but he does, to generate a period equal to that that took its name from Thatcher, and that which took its name from Blair. There won't be one that takes its name from Cameron, because he doesn't have that originative capacity, but right. Certainly, you know, a Major didn't, but Thatcher did, and Blair did, and I think Gove has that quality, intellectually anyway, which wasn't necessarily the case with Thatcher or Blair.
So it's sort of a miniature epoch?
Epoch, yeah, I think so. I think that we're looking at a miniature epoch in potentially, but also because this is a very unstable moment in British political history. We're going to be creating something completely anew. It's never something that's been done by anybody before. We're going through a completely new process.
But you look forward to that optimistically.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I think it gives an opportunity for, even for little people like us, to speak and perhaps be heard, and for others to speak again, and for influences to gradually trickle down and take seed, because the control elements, you know, the gatekeepers of public discourse, have really lost a fantastic amount of their capacities to, you know, dictate what happens. And this is a moment of real looseness and opportunity.
That's so great.
You know, I think
maybe he'll start following us at the majority.
Well, you never know. No, I don't think anybody's about to start following us. I shouldn't worry about that. What did you think that Marine Le Pen was following us?
I did.
Yeah.
For three minutes. I was so happy.
Oh, well.
Well, you mentioned gatekeepers, so we should talk about the phenomenon of Theresa May and the fact that she suddenly appeared as the supposed front runner. Mm. Or at least that's what they're saying she is now. Yes, so what did you think of her, GW?
Well, I thought very little of her until I saw her kitten shoes, which would have been around about 2005 or 6 or something, in which she, which was the speech in which she stood up in these pair of cat house shoes and called her own party nasty, which, you know, gave an opportunity for the Labour Party chorus to, you know, repeat. It was sort of, in terms of own goal, well, it stands alone. You know, let's call ourselves the Nasty Party. How about that? Oh yeah, it's a really great idea. So she's always had this unfortunate tendency, in my view, to get things wrong. She has been as a Home Secretary since 2010, a total disaster. She's presided over the most enormous growth of immigration. She's done absolutely nothing about it. She's had failure after failure in her attempts to deport various Islamist freaks. And, you know,
She got rid of Abu Qatada, though.
Well, she did eventually, but it did take about 2 years, didn't it, to do or more?
Yes. It's because she had to keep battling with the European courts and
I know.
And then there was the thing with the...
And then she wants to remain.
Yeah, and she wants to remain, but subscribe to that, because she doesn't think she has a mandate to get rid of it, which is bad leadership. If she really hates it that much, she's trying to get out of it then.
Yeah.
The thing that I'll let her off on, though, is, well, at least I thought that I should let her off on, is the migration problem. Because during the time that the UK was a member of the European Union, she didn't have any control over intra-European migration anyway. So when they said, oh, you're going to get it down to tens of thousands, they knew that was impossible in the without exiting the EU.
Yeah.
Or at least it should have been impossible without exiting the EU, right?
Well, they all knew that before, and they were told it. There was a paper issued to, privately issued to them by somebody within the Home Office, I think, some sort of high civil servant, which pointed out that it could not be done while membership of the union obtained. So they knew it, but they still went ahead with this manifesto promise. So, you know, we're not talking about honest people here, are we? And she's party to that.
Yeah.
And I thought her dishonesty
was... Yeah, one of the other big disappointments from her as well was in the manifesto, I'm sure that I recall that there was stuff about dealing with vulnerable women, people who have been trafficked, and so on. There was supposed to be a task force created for this. I'm sure that was in the manifesto. Do you remember? Do either of you remember this?
I don't remember that. No.
There was a section. I'm very sure that there was a women's section in which those things were dealt with. And I remember trying to encourage people to rethink their animosity toward the Tory party, because perhaps there is some merit in this, because these pages here, which essentially contained that stuff, were promising these things. You know what she actually did? That was one of the biggest disappointments from her. She dismantled these things. Not only did she dismantle them, she dismantled them before they even were implemented, and then dismantled more of the stuff that already existed to deal with that kind of stuff also. Very, very strange. She also dismantled some of the stuff that Labour had brought in to deal with these kind of things also. So I'm just thinking, what are you doing?
She's an enigma, isn't she?
I can't figure her out.
By her behaviour with this referendum, when, you know, she's presented herself actually to the party as being a lifelong Eurosceptic, but as others did who were supposedly lifelong Eurosceptics, she chose career and went with David Cameron. However, she didn't think it was necessarily proven that they would win, so she hid behind the sofa and never said a word for the entire campaign. So there's somebody who is trying to walk on both sides of the street in each direction, I think.
And you're going to get hit by cars on both sides.
And, you know, my expectation was that she would wind up being condemned from both sides for this. Just inevitable, I thought. You know, but no, this is politics.
Apparently not.
Yeah, this is politics. There's loads of people who are coming out and thinking to yourself, oh, she's a winner. I need a job. That's what they think about. The careerists, you know. They're out there trying to secure their futures, and they're looking for coattails. So I think that she's presenting a fine pair of coattails, and quite a lot of them are leaping on. What we've got at the moment is a situation where May is currently leading, but then she got out of the blocks first, where Gove is now coming up, notwithstanding the fact that he's got a very difficult task ahead of him to convince the membership that he didn't knife Boris and therefore should not be the man who, you know, which is...
Whoever wields the knife becomes Michael Heseltine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the stalking horse never wins the race.
Exactly. Doomed to haunt the corridors of power forever, but never actually occupy the powerful seat.
Exactly. Well said. So, third, we've got Andrew Leadsom, who's, I'm pretty sure, not a serious contender for prime ministership. I think there's some sort of romantic feeling that she could be another Maggie. Maybe it's true, but I feel that the wisdom of the crowd on this occasion, the Tory crowd, will be to select between May and Gove. But I've been wrong a lot in this affair so far, and I might well be wrong again.
Is this a decent place to segue into relations now with the rest of Europe? There's some news coming out of Austria that would seem, on surface of it, to be big news for nationalists. But with your insight, you say no, that the Austrian elections are going to be.
It is big news, but you know, but it's big news in the sense that we've had no news for a long time. Brexit is not a nationalist. Or directly, you know, nationalist-produced development. It's not a product of people who think like us. It's a product of people who are patriots and who have, you know, very good instincts about many things.
We're not patriots?
Well, we are, but they do not have the analysis which we have, which is a fundamentally an ethnic analysis and a life analysis.
You're criticizing Farage now.
So I am, yes, and all those who will, go so far but won't make that essential stride to support the life of their own people.
Right.
And it is an essential thing if one's going to be a real and true patriot, I would say. However,
good point.
Rather than just a civic one.
The Austrian election really is
a nationalist triumph. And one, has to say that if they now pull it off, that's a big deal for nationalists. But it isn't a big deal in raw political terms. Nothing like the deal that Brexit is. It's not a percent of what Brexit is.
Okay, the audience doesn't have the context of what's being discussed.
Well, okay, under the Austrian constitution, the president has very limited powers.
But go to the news story first, that the election results have been annulled.
Yes, the election has been annulled and will be rerun probably October, maybe September, and will be between the same two individuals, that's Alexander Van Bellen and Norbert Hofer. And we should see, I think, a victory this time for Hofer, because I suspect that voter exhaustion will afflict the the establishment forces. They're going to be rather disheartened by this. They thought they won. They're not going to find it so easy to get the energy again to push off and do this job. Whereas, on the other hand, the nationalist inclined vote, I have to say nationalist inclined because they're not all nationalists, only something like 26 or 28% of them or something of that order was nationalists, will find a lot more energy and vigor and anger, and they'll be saying they cheated us. I'm not going to let them do it again. So I do expect that Hofer will come through, but as president, he's not going to be able to effect any direct political change himself, because his role is chiefly ceremonial and has a high import in moments of constitutional importance, such as swearing in governments and so on, but not for determining policy in any way. So it's a very important movement for nationalism, but politically the real deal is Brexit. That's the way I see it.
Okay. Now, shall we move on to Turkey? There's been some events there. Kumiko, do you have any updates on Turkey?
Well, what would you like me to update them on?
Well, there's been an airport bombing, you tell me that ISIS would have been quite happy if that had been blamed on the Kurds.
Yes, well, yeah, that's the whole point. The attack on the airport, which I'm sure everyone has seen the video footage of, and so on and so forth. Obviously, ISIL people, some of them. Sort of, I guess you'd call it a multiracial ISIS attack, or ISIL, I should say, attack. The three suicide bombers were an Uzbek, a Kajik? Or is it Kyrgyz?
Kyrgyz.
Okay. An Uzbek, a Kyrgyz, and someone from Dagestan for the third bomber. The reason why these people did not immediately claim it for the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham after it had been carried out is because, due to the fact that Turkey has been dealing with insurgency from the PKK, which is a Kurdish party, alongside the TKP-ML and other Marxist groups in Turkey, they would like to blame all terrorist attacks on those groups because they're kind of using ISIL at this point to fight against those groups, because, as you all know, Turkey has been covertly supplying ISIL, quote, by accident. So whenever an attack happens, they prefer to blame it on the PKK than to blame it on anyone else. This is why when ISIL carries out attacks in Turkey, they do not claim credit for these attacks, because they're hoping that the Turkish state will reciprocate by blaming on the PKK. This time around, security forces were actually able to capture some people or something, and it became apparent that these people were actually ISIL. And so then it became announced pretty quickly after the attack took place that ISIL had perpetrated it. And that's how we ended up finding out that it was ISIL who had perpetrated it.
Now, yesterday you said that I was,
all of this,
I was going to the matter too quickly.
All of this is blowback. All of this is blowback, of course.
All right. Yesterday, you said that I was moving to the issue too quickly of your hopes for the PKK, is it, the Kurds in Turkey?
Yes. Yes, but I wouldn't focus on that. I wouldn't focus on them alone. It's obviously they're in a coalition with others, and people often don't talk about this coalition which they are in. So I will read off to you what the coalition is. So hold on. Right. So they're in a coalition, which was announced, I think it was in February of this year. 10 revolutionary organizations have joined together to fight against Turkey. And the PKK executive committee member, Duran Kalkan, has said that these groups, which will become a glimmer of hope for the peoples, quote unquote, are the TKPML, which is a Maoist organization, the PKK, which is, of course, Kurdish communists, the THKP-C, which is also designated as a terrorist group by Turkey, the MKP, the TKP Leninists, TKIP, DKP, and Demirci, Karagah, and MLKP. All of these groups are essentially socialist or communist groups that have been having insurgency against Turkey for the longest time now, because they believe that the Turkish government is a semi-feudalist, semi-colonialist government, which is linking hands with Islamists in order to suppress the economic development of the people. And so that fight continues on that border. It then merged into a fight against ISIL, because when ISIL appeared on the scene in northern Iraq, they were threatening the Kurds at that time, as you all know. And so it's at this point that these same groups also then declared war against ISIL at the same time.
Now, this goes to an overall opinion of yours that we in certain circumstances, we should actually side or encourage, root for, if not actively aid Marxist groups against Islamic groups. But how do, I mean, that's a very unpopular kind of position in Western liberalism.
I would put to them perhaps a survey question of, if they can't choose between Islamists and Marxists, then the war on terror is a complete farce. If they can't make this choice, it should be an elementary choice. One of them is manifestly progressive.
But it goes against all
Americans. They've been clamoring against. September 2001.
I agree with you, but it goes against all American conditioning.
American conditioning isn't supposed to make sense, though, is it?
Well, they're against. It's been against communism since post World War II. That's been the big, big ogre. So,
when you're dealing with international politics, you have to be able to think on your feet. What is an ideology other than a set of stratagems that a particular class or ethnic group uses to advance its own cause in the world?
It's simple for you, but not necessarily for an American audience that's been conditioned and immersed in a certain media and perspective. They're not being presented these options in such clear terms.
You simply made the argument quite simply. I mean, in the Turkish context, it's very simple. Once you've established that Turkey is a semi-feudalist and semi-colonialist country, then it becomes quite clear to see what people who are opposed to this are going to have to do. If you're choosing not to side with bureaucratic bourgeois, and you're choosing not to side with essentially, you know, clerics prancing around in mosques, then you have relatively few social classes remaining that you can link yourself to. Two social classes remaining? The working class and the peasants. If those are the only two groups you have that are actually on your side, then why not just be a socialist and get it over with?
Of course, you're right, and it's simple to you. I just think you might be underestimating the kind of the media flood which drowns out this simple matter to an American audience. I mean, an American audience and white nationalist audience, they think that Russia and China are best friends, and that they're going to be aligned against us, and we better get our act together, because we're going to get big trouble.
That's an aside, but geostrategically, no, that is not the case either. I think the only thing that China and Russia both seem to agree on at this moment, although for different reasons and completely by accident, is the fact that Turkey has offended Russia because of the jet they shot down, if you recall, which they're now trying to apologize for because they're desperate. And obviously, Turkey has offended China because it keeps funding militant jihadist groups in areas that China has an interest in, such as Xinjiang province, which is actually inside China. So there, you know, in 2006, actually, there were conversations about this where China had issued the Turks an ultimatum and said that, you know, if Turkey doesn't stop touching Islamic groups inside of Xinjiang, then China will reciprocate by touching Maoist groups and the PKK inside of Turkish territory. And since Turkey did not heed this message, then you've seen the result. Magically and you know, very coincidentally, arms and money have been flowing toward those groups in Turkey.
Now this does
connect. And until such time as Turkey stops doing this, then at that time China will stop funding the thing which is annoying Turkey. Then
this does connect to the EU because China's building this, is extending its Silk Road, its railroad into the EU, and it has a couple of routes. One would be on the north side of the Black Sea, and the other is perhaps through Turkey. I think we might hope, preferably somehow through the Adriatic Sea. But at any rate, they're coming into Eastern Europe and what's perhaps known as the Intermarium, hopefully known as the Intermarium nations.
Well, you say coming into Eastern Europe. It's only a collection of deals. The 16+1 arrangement is supposed to have the Central and Eastern Europeans put into trade deals for infrastructure development and trade.
Well, that's significant.
This does not include Western Europe for reasons which are obvious, because they don't need infrastructure, because I think they basically have those things down pat. The other factor in this that has left the opening for this is that since 2008, the situations regarding, you know, policies taken by the ECB, ones of austerity and so on, have been such that it has left a kind of a slack, an opening, where China could enter, because of the fact that the European Union is not really united, at least not in a functional sense. After all, you've seen the youth unemployment in places in the south of Europe, and you've seen how the east of Europe has not undergone the kind of development that should be undergone. So China has decided to take advantage of the fact that this is the way that it is. When I say take advantage, I don't mean in a negative sense. I mean take advantage in a positive sense, because everybody wins from that kind of arrangement anyway. If the EU doesn't want to do what it's supposed to do, then someone else has to step up to the plate.
Would you say that China would prefer to go through the southern route, through Turkey or the Adriatic, as opposed to going through Russia?
I don't think they have a preference. I don't think that. Well, actually, yes, they do have a preference. The preference is not through Russia, obviously, as you just mentioned. I didn't even know you were considering a Russian route still, because that's never going to happen.
But that's how bad it is.
They would never do a Russian route.
You think it's obvious? Paul Craig Roberts is pretty famous, and he's addressing an American audience as if they better be shaking in their boots because. China and Russia are getting closer and closer into bed with one another.
No, the road is deliberately drawn around Russia. And this has been known since the mid 90s.
You know this, and I know this, but white nationalists in particular don't know this. They don't know the kind of antipathy that China has for Russia. And you know how meaningful that is for geopolitics. You've pretty much, isn't that true, that you pretty much have to make a choice? It's of who you're going to go with, because they're not going to get along. Am I misunderstanding that?
Yeah, ultimately, because what's happened now is because of the sanctions which have been leveled against Russia, which is, I guess you call it fortuitous, that sanctions were leveled against Russia, because it forced them into an interesting position where they had to become increasingly dependent upon China, even though China had no intention of ever reciprocating for Russia. So Russia has in fact lost status vis-a-vis China as a result of this sort of ping pong game that's been going on.
And isn't that true, so, that Japan falls in line?
I guess you could say that's one positive aspect.
Is it not true that Japan falls in line with China, and so does South Korea?
I would not use the phrasing fall in line, but they're not going to back Russia, obviously. No, they won't. But I would not use the phrasing fall in line. They all have their own reasons for doing what they do.
Okay.
Also, since you mentioned South Korea, there's often a perception that China backs North Korea to the hilt. That is actually not true either. China obviously sees South Korea as a bigger trading partner because money talks. North Korea has become kind of a nuisance. The function of North Korea these days seems to be to escalate destabilization, to act as a buffer, and to make Russians feel as though they are relevant, because every single time North Korea does something stupid, Russia tries to invite itself to the table to have discussions on how to resolve the problems.
Makes sense.
And so on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, if you think about it, the Korean Peninsula is a strategic location, which is why everyone has been fighting over it. I mean, Japan sought to control it after 1905, which was quite obviously going to happen. The reason that Russia was trying to infiltrate the area in the first place was because they recognized the value of it. In fact, Russia fought no more than 4 different wars to try to get itself into the Northern Korean Peninsula. And the reason that the Americans in the post-war environment immediately had to have a Korean War was precisely because of the strategic use of that location.
This is all part of a general strategy, as I understand. You tell me that Russia sort of runs its economy through a kind of territorial aggrandissement and resource acquisition and trade rather than industrial development. Is that an accurate characterization, according to you?
Yes. This has been pointed out by me before. That a question I always like to ask people is, can you name one product in your house which is manufactured in Russia, other than firearms?
No, I can't.
Exactly. So at some point in time, you have to come to the conclusion that Russians really largely,
the electricity.
For a nation of their size, they're essentially rent seekers at this point. Even in terms of their exports, because people always say, oh, well, they're an energy exporter. Okay, and where is that energy being exported from? The areas of Siberia that they occupy? So it's still rent seeking. You're occupying someone else's land and then exporting resources which they would have had you not occupied their land. So other than that, what else do they have?
I think that most people in the West are not aware of this dispute that parts of the Russian Federation aren't.
They should be aware.
Aren't properly Russian. Or they're not thinking a whole lot about it.
It should be quite obvious. All they have to do is look at their faces. The western part of Russia around Muscovy and around, essentially everything west of the Ural Mountains, am I right? Everything west of that position kind of looks like white people, to put it crudely. And then everything that's to the east of that position starts not looking so much. I mean, that alone, even if they didn't know the history, just visually, they should be able to see this.
Okay, so what's the vastness of the territory you would dispute, but now it seems they are even going beyond that and interfering to the south, to what you call the Silk Road nations. And what's that about?
Central Asia. I wouldn't call it interference. They've always been trying to interfere there. So at some point, it's not even like they're starting interference. They're continuing their interference in other people's affairs, essentially. However, China's strategy in that zone is to continue their investment and to expand their money payment system and so on, to integrate these countries into, you know, China's economic sphere. And Russia's being slowly but surely pushed out of those areas. Russia would like to expand back into the post-Soviet space, but they've been unable to accomplish this because China has been doing everything to make sure that cannot happen admirably. The same process was going on with regards to Ukraine. What happened in Ukraine was quite interesting because the Americans jumped the gun and actually started shooting before
the Americans with
shooting.
The Americans with echoes, with big echoes though.
They started encouraging the shooting before it was supposed to happen. There wasn't supposed
Victoria
to be
a new one.
China's preference was that Ukraine should eventually enter into the European Union and should become integrated into the European Union and establish relationships with China, part of the Silk Road project, Silk Road and Belt.
We didn't need a hot war to do that.
Ukraine, as you know. What happened instead was they kind of jumped the gun and started fighting China's preference.
Yeah, but you're talking about echo, when something like that is very Jewish characteristics, that sort of.
We have to think about it this way. It's Yanukovych we're talking about, right?
I suppose.
Who was thrown out.
Former president.
I sometimes get... Yes, him. Right. So, you know, he was extremely corrupt, I would say, right? We all agree that he was a corrupt person.
Yeah.
I guess you could say the strategy, quote unquote, was supposed to be relying on his corruption, that, you know, the EU could buy him off eventually and that he would take Ukraine perhaps into the European Union, which would solve all of our problems in one go. That did not happen, of course, because they decided to go with the shooting method. He got chucked out, and then they had to install another government, which they did do. And then that government had to try to get accession to the European Union, which, of course, was difficult now because of the fact that there's a conflict going on. And usually you can't start talking about drawing closer and acceding to the European Union if you have a conflict going on in half of your country. So that was inconvenient. But from the far-off perspective, if you step really far back, so long as the outcome is a Ukraine which is not connected to Russia, then you've accomplished the objective. China, however,
even if you lose the eastern part and Crimea.
No, that's not supposed to happen. That wasn't supposed to happen either. Obviously,
Victoria Nuland and her husband Kagan, who was involved with Operation Clean Sweep, obviously didn't care about these subtleties and had other things in mind, namely Israeli interests.
It could have been that they simply overestimated how capable the Ukrainian army was going to be, because I cannot imagine they would have thought that it was okay to cut the country in half. Otherwise, why would they be fighting over it anyway? Particularly since
what you might be able to imagine is that they wouldn't care that much to have a go at it.
No, but I'm trying to say that the eastern part of the country contains a lot of productivity which is going on, which would have been nice to have kept integrated with the country, because the country cannot function properly if you bisect it in that way. So obviously they would not want it to be bisected. No one wanted it to be bisected in that way, particularly since it would have been very nice actually if the whole country had flipped as one, because many of the things being produced in these factories are, you know, things which are produced for the military industrial complex in Russia, for example. It would have been nice to get one's hands on everything that they were producing to find out what exactly they were doing. Mm. That would have been nice.
Well, that's a bit, I guess, from my perspective, that all sounds rash and like a product of Jewish uncaring. For all I know, Victoria Nuland was at the heart of that initiative.
Was she incompetent, or was she up to some kind of secret plan?
She didn't care.
She didn't
really care. It was about stirring up confusion and creating a situation that could be taken advantage of by Jewish interests, because they have a lot of presence in Ukraine as well, especially now with those who've gone into power. Is my understanding, and they were so cynical as to even be ostensibly backing Banderas, the Nazistic groups.
I'll get to that in a second. One thing which perhaps listeners will be wondering, how can I prove what I'm saying? One of the proofs of how Russia and China were divided on this issue was China's preference for a Ukraine that was aligned to the West and to the European Union can be seen most clearly through the fact that the Chinese embassy submitted an actual complaint and an announcement of an investigation into what Russia was doing, because Russia had actually bought surveillance equipment from China and then lied to them about what the surveillance equipment was for. And it was a company named JC Altron which had done this, and they had employed this equipment to spy on Ukrainian officials in the run-up to the events which took place, which sparked the Ukrainian civil war. And so you would think that if Russia and China were on the same side, China would not complain to Russia about their equipment being deployed in this way. But they did. They instead sent Russia a letter warning them very harshly and saying that they were going to open up and unravel everything that had gone on here, because it was incredibly inappropriate that they had taken Chinese equipment and utilized it against the Ukrainian government that was trying to align itself to the European Union. So they were angry about it. They were angry about the Russian actions. And that alone, if anyone was having any questions or doubts about it, shows that they're at odds on this issue.
Yeah, but you're unsorting something very subtle that, again, white nationalists would need to know, which is that Israel or Jewish interests in diaspora as well would be more tangled up with Russia and to some extent Ukraine as well, and more able to manipulate them than China, of course, and they would have to do it in straight business terms with with China, but they'll have more blood and historical ties with Russia and even Ukraine.
True. But what do you think they were intending to do in that situation?
China?
No, I mean the Israelis then, because you've invoked them.
Well, what have they?
What do you think they're trying to do?
The same thing that they're doing throughout the Middle East and North Africa with Operation Clean Break. It seems like they're trying to create mayhem and disempower any regime that could potentially rise to challenge them. And I think that.
But to what end, though? Why would they want to? For instance, like,
so that they could take over. So they could take control. They can put their puppets in control in Ukraine. And it's very valuable territory, they could take control of Libya. They can take control of all the Middle Eastern states.
No, but you're linking these things.
What specifically
about Ukraine were they trying to accomplish? That's what I'm asking, because chaos is one thing, but chaos has to have a purpose, right?
Yeah. Well, Ukraine, it's got a bridge between Europe and Russia. It's valuable, very valuable farming land. They have historical ties there. I mean, they're very intermarried with Ukrainians. So maybe it's a trivial example, but if you have Ukrainian mothers, right, and Jewish fathers, their children can't be Israelis. Where are they going to go? The best place for them to go is Ukraine.
Well, the thing which I'm at, no, why, I thought, why, if, would, I
why,
thought
wouldn't,
if,
why wouldn't they want to take control of Ukraine?
Perhaps it's a war against the Kiev Rus.
Matter of fact, that's why it's so Russian now. It's because this was once a Ukrainian area, but after the famine, is my understanding, they had to bring in a population from Muscovy, and that's
had to bring in. Well, that was the design. That was the purpose.
Okay, you know, but still, and that was Kaganovich, who, my understanding, is a blood relative to Kagan, Victoria Nuland's husband, and Kagan is also intimately involved with Operation Clean Break from the start, and all these plans, whether it's Operation Desert Storm or Gaddafi.
My question on their competence then is that if there is that blood connection between Kaganovich and actually Kagan, then why didn't they just back Yanukovych, oppose China and oppose the European Union and support Russia? Why did they not just side with Russia and get it over with if that's what they're intending to do?
Perhaps because they want to use Russia to kill Ukrainians. I don't know.
That would make sense. It would.
The point
they
is
don't, they don't
that,
care if European you know, lives
if
are being
you, if you if you operate from, and I'm not saying I do, but there are people who do, operate from the presumption that the Kiev Rus were responsible for the destruction of the Khazar Empire and for the sundering of the Khazar people and eventually for their sufferings all over Europe in diaspora. You know,
maybe more important even than that is that the Khazar land, which would be very valuable to Jews to have,
Let's assume for a moment that the interest in what is modern day Ukraine has a not dissimilar interest for Ashkenazim, that Israel, the land of Yisrael, has for Jews in general, and that this is something which is very difficult for us to acknowledge or understand, but may have sufficient historical antecedents. We don't know really, because the history of the Khazars is so mysterious and disputed, but it is something for us to take into account anyway, and consider as one more possible explanation for what's going on. Otherwise you would have to say, well, why would Jews express a particular interest in that part of the world?
Yeah, and also express it in a way that would not seem to be, you know, what you would naturally expect from them.
And
because
if you
I would have expected
Sephardics,
that if they knew what they were doing, they would support...
You know, support. A Mizrahim going in there and messing around, then you would say, okay, that's just something I don't understand. But if they're fundamentally all Ashkenazim, then that might be suspicious. I have no idea. It's just a line of thought that some nationalists undoubtedly would seize upon and you know, people who know a lot more about that than I do, because I don't make a habit of studying any of this stuff.
I'd say also in terms of the incompetence question mark issue on this as well, that when they do these things, they're unlocking forces that they cannot control. And I've told you this before. For example, these people who came in from Denmark or wherever it was that they brought in, they brought in, which were literally Nazis in some case. Why would they want to unlock that kind of social force if it's going to be so antagonistic toward them? Then there's also on top of that,
divide and conquer.
There's the Chechen diaspora, the part of the Chechen population which is not Islamist but rather is nationalistic first and foremost, that had been hiding out in Europe for the longest time because they had fled from Russia. This conflict essentially brought all these people back as kind of like Chechen battalions, and they had that guy, you know, stomping around talking about how he's going to kill Russians and Jews until the day he dies. All this kind of stuff had been, you know, unleashed into the midst of this. They had people being brought from Central Asia who had beef in the game essentially and wanted to have beef with everything from Russians to Kiev and Jews to everyone there basically. Why would they allow that kind of social force to be unleashed? Why would they allow that kind of social force to be unleashed into the middle of Ukraine if they were actually competent?
Why would they want to? Why you asked that question? But why would they want to take Assad out of power?
Well, that one's obvious. They want to break the Shia Crescent. That one actually makes some sense. It's bad, but it makes sense. When I say that something makes sense, that doesn't mean it's good. It just means that I understand why they did it. In the case of the Ukrainian thing, I'm not saying that what they did was good or bad. I'm saying what they did doesn't appear to make sense. And so that's why I'm drawing the conclusion that they must be incompetent. Because it seems as though it's not even serving their own interest. They're just blowing stuff up in front of their own faces. In the case of what they did to Assad, that was an attempt to break the Shia Crescent and remove the ability of Assad's chemical weapons battalions from deterring Israel's nondescript, ambiguous nuclear deterrent itself. So that makes some sense. So you can see the malevolence is there, but it's a sensible malevolence. You can understand the logic behind what they're trying to do to people.
Does what happened in Egypt make sense after Mubarak?
Yes, but not from the perspective that you're thinking of. From an American hegemony perspective, that makes sense. They had Mubarak in power. The broad mass of the people decided that they were sick of him because the Arab Spring had come. So then America, rather than thinking to itself, oh, defend Mubarak at all costs, they decided to put Mubarak under the bus for the sake of quote-unquote democracy in the hopes that the NGOs which were planted inside of Egyptian society and which had connections to the Muslim Brotherhood could be used to finesse the result so that when the revolution quote-unquote took place, that which would replace Mubarak would also be beholden to the United States. And so that happened to a limited extent. The Muslim Brotherhood got into power, everything looked like it was going to be hunky-dory, and then they started wavering and doing all kinds of things that America didn't want them to do. So that was when America decided, oops, something has gone wrong here. Support al-Sisi against the Muslim Brotherhood, which had just been installed, and then have the revolution fully revolve back to where it started.
Okay, so let me come back to Ukraine for just a second.
To suggest how
it looks from my point of view, that this headlong initiative, to me, has all the hallmarks of not only Jewish chutzpah, but Jewish hubris. I do believe that they have both sides. They have representatives on both sides in the Russian and Ukrainian conflict, and that they thought that they were going to be able to muster ultra-nationalists, even Nazistic people, to their side and keep them under control.
Well, this is the root of my question. Why, if they're assuming that they are logical human beings, which I tend to assume, assuming they're logical human beings and that they're supposed to be not incompetent, why would they have chosen to play both sides when one of them was clearly already serving their interest, i.e. Russia was already serving their interest? Russia was, I mean, I hate to put it this way, but, you know, Russia is essentially a Israeli combine, let me put it that way. So why would they have wanted Yanukovych to be gone at all in the first place, right?
I don't think that they did want him to be taken out necessarily. Except, well,
Well, then why did Newland do what she did? That's why I concluded she was
Okay, maybe she was incompetent. But you know, they did put Jews in power, to my understanding, in most political offices. That's the case there now.
Yeah, but they also have half the country in war at the same time. So why this is the question of why I'm asked about the combat is, because they had it good before.
Would they
and then
care?
They fucked it all up for the purpose of
would
doing
they care,
what?
Would they care if those parts fell into Russian hands? Like, probably not. Not Jews.
Hmm.
This conversation is not merely circular, but multi-circular. It is going round and round and round. I think that what I'll do for the sake of the listener, there will be somebody listening to this, is to pull the rug on it. And thank you both. I don't know how much light emerged from that. It's a fair bit of heat from time to time, surprisingly so. But okay, I shall look forward to editing it all down, and I will put it up on the site in the same way we did the other half earlier today.